For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. We're studying Elijah, and we're in chapter 18 this evening. He says in verse 1, "Now after many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah." And so, if you've been with us these last couple of weeks as we've gotten our series going, you'll know that there is this repetition of phrases that kind of work its way through the narrative, kind of hold the thing together. So we need to understand that when we're reading this important section of Israel's history, that we are indeed reading history. It's not mythology. It's not just a bunch of stories that have been compiled over a period of time. But these are firsthand chronicles of events that are taking place in Israel's history, much of which actually is documented by archaeological information, what we know about the surrounding environment outside of Israel. And so here, when it says that the word of the Lord came, it really is saying that God is superintending the unfolding of human history. That history is not just a meaningless sequence of events, and neither is it something that is utterly under the control of human agents who are freely doing what human people do. Civilizations come and go. But God has a plan in human history, and He has assigned His prophets to be the mouthpiece by which that plan is made evident to people. And so the word of the Lord is this pronouncement of God, that this is where things are going. This is what I will and what I intend to accomplish. And so here it is. We saw it seven times in the narrative last week in chapter 17. And it introduces our narrative here tonight. The word of the Lord came to Elijah. So God is once again revealing Himself. God is once again on the move. And it says it came in the third year of the drought, saying, "Go show yourself to Ahab, and I'll send rain on the face of the earth." And so again, just by way of background, for those of us who weren't here over the last couple of weeks, Ahab is the king of Israel. Ahab has a wife named Jezebel, who is not from the families of Abraham. She is not from Israel at all. She is, in fact, from Sidon, which is in modern-day Lebanon. And she has brought back into this marriage of convenience that was an attempt by Ahab to unite the Phoenician peoples with the Israelis to bring in shipping and in that sense prosperity and defense of their borders for purely political and economic reasons. Ahab enters into this marriage, but it comes with a hook, in which is that she brings with her the prophets of her religious cult, which is Baalism, and they institute essentially a new religious rule on Israel, forsaking the worship of God and now erecting these temples and these altars to sacrifice and to worship Baal. And God is not okay with that. And a couple of weeks ago, we made this point that God is moved to anger by what this means because of the dehumanizing betrayal of the worship of the God who has brought Israel and into existence and into their place. And now, having turned their back on the God of history and the God who loves them and called them, they're now prostituting themselves literally before this fertility God that requires from them the sacrifice even of their own children, this dehumanizing cult. And so God has pronounced a verdict on this God of the storm, and by causing drought to come upon the land. What better evidence could there be that the one true God reigns supreme over the polytheistic nature deities that were worshipped in the ancient Near Eastern world? That's the setting. We read on. It says, "So Elijah went to appear before Ahab. Meanwhile, the famine had becomes severe in Samaria, the capital of Israel. And so Ahab summoned Obadiah, who was in charge of the palace. And then we have this parenthetical note from our historian and author of this text. Obadiah was a devoted follower of the Lord. And once Jezebel had tried to kill the Lord's prophets, Obadiah had hidden 100 of them in 2 caves. He put 50 prophets in each cave and supplied them food and water. Now Ahab said to Obadiah, "We must check every spring and valley in the land to see if we can find enough grass to save at least some of my horses and mules." And so they divided the land between them. Ahab went one way by himself. Obadiah went another way by himself. And as Obadiah was walking along, he suddenly saw Elijah coming toward him. And Obadiah recognized him at once and bowed down to the ground before him. "Is it really you, my lord Elijah?" he asked. "Yes," Elijah replied. "Now go and tell your master Elijah's here." Well, Obadiah protests, "What harm have I done that you're sending me to my death at the hands of Ahab? For I swear by the Lord your God that the king has searched every nation and kingdom on earth from end to end to find you. And each time he was told, Elijah isn't here. And Ahab forced the king of that nation to swear the truth of his claim. And now I say to you," now you say, "go to tell your master Elijah is here, but soon as I leave, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you away to who knows where. And when Ahab comes and cannot find you, he's going to kill me. I'm in a pickle. Yet I have been true as a servant of the Lord all my life. Has no one told you, my Lord, about the time when Jezebel was trying to kill the Lord's prophets? How I hid 100 of them in 2 caves and supported them with food and water. And now you say, go and tell your master Elijah is here. If I do that, Ahab will certainly kill me." Now, this is a really interesting introduction to the main part of our meal tonight that we're going to read in just a second. Because it shows us that while Israel is in headlong rebellion against God, that all of the priests of God have fled down to the south, down to Judah, while there has been a slaughter of people who would stand up and speak for God in Israel, nonetheless, there is this one man, Obadiah, who was actually close in proximity to the king, a sort of a prime minister, as it were, someone who was presiding over his household and taking care of all of the details of his kingdom. This man, Obadiah, was actually secretly, very much underground, a worshiper of the one true God, a worshiper of Yahweh, the God of Israel. And he had taken the privilege of his position to do everything in his power to protect what remained of a witness for God in Israel. These 100 prophets are people who are basically, they are itinerant speakers. They go around from village to village and they speak the truth about God from God's word. And so they're in hiding now by Obadiah's provision. And Obadiah realizes, look, if I'm singled out and I'm killed, it's not just my life, but it's also who's going to protect these people who remain. And so that's the situation that he finds himself in. But the text moves on rather quickly. It says in verse 15, Elijah says, "I swear by the Lord Almighty in whose presence I stand that I will present myself to Ahab this very day." Okay? So the Spirit's not going to like do one of those Star Trek things where you're in the transporter and 1 minute you're there and boom, 1 minute you're somewhere else. That's not going to be a problem. So Obadiah is not going to be exposed in that way. And so he says in verse 16 that he went to tell Ahab that Elijah had come, and Ahab went out to meet him. Well, Ahab saw him. It's been 3 years. And he exclaimed, "So, is it really you, you troublemaker of Israel?" You who by the word of the Lord have caused this drought to make us destitute? Elijah responds, verse 18, I've made no trouble for Israel. You and your family are the troublemakers, for you have refused to obey the commandments of the Lord and have worshipped the image of Baal instead. Now summon all Israel and join me at Mount Carmel, along with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah, who Jezebel supports. So Ahab summoned all the people of Israel and the prophets to Mount Carmel. And that's a little picture of it right there, high on that plateau. And Elijah stood in front of them all, and he said, how much longer will you waver, hobbling between two opinions? That's why our talk tonight is entitled, Where Do You Stand? Here's a moment of decision. If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, then follow him. But the people were completely silent. The people were really stuck in this binary position. Worship God or worship Baal. There's going to be no fusing of these two things. Where do you stand? And the people recognize the extraordinary danger of standing on either ground. If we stand with the Lord God, Yahweh of Israel, then we have Ahab, Jezebel, and all of that against us. We know what kind of people they are, and we know what kind of danger that represents. On the other hand, we also know who God is. The God of history, the God who has liberated us from the Egyptians so many years ago and has preserved us in this very precarious place called Israel. This place that is the intersection of Asia and Europe and Africa, and where major powers emerge and seize it historically to their liking. Where do we go? What shall we choose? Silence. It's deafening silence. We don't know where God's people stand. Well, it reads on. Elijah said to them, I'm the only prophet of the Lord who is left. Is that true? That's not true. That's going to become very important when we read next time the rest of chapter 18. Now, he says to the prophets of Baal, bring two bulls. And so the prophets of Baal may choose whichever one they wish, and to cut it into pieces and lay it on the wood of their altar, but not to set fire to it. And then he says, call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by setting fire to the wood is the true God. And all the people are like, okay, that's fair. It's a competition. Let's see which God is able to light my fire. Okay, which one's it going to be? And so Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, you go first. For there are many of you. And choose one of the bulls and prepare it and call on the name of your God. But don't set the wood on fire. Let him do that. So they prepared one of the bulls and placed it on the altar. And then they called on the name of Baal from morning until noontime, shouting, oh, Baal, answer us. But there was no reply. And so they began to dance around the altar that they had made. And around noontime, Elijah began mocking them. You'll have to shout a little louder, he scoffed. For surely he is a god. Perhaps he's daydreaming or is out relieving himself. Or maybe he's away on a trip or asleep and needs to be awakened. So they shouted louder and followed their normal custom. They cut themselves with knives and swords until the blood gushed out. And they raved all afternoon until the evening sacrifice. But there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. That is one of the most somber sentences in the Bible. All of this effort to make the idol speak, to make the idol act, to prove himself, ends in silence. And so we read on that Elijah called the people and said, come over here. And they crowded around him as he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been torn down by Jezebel and her buddies. He took 12 stones, one representing each of the tribes of Israel, to rebuild their altar. And then he dug a trench around the altar large enough to hold about 3 gallons of water. He piled wood on the altar, cut the bull into pieces, and laid the pieces on the wood. And then he said, fill 4 water jars, or large jars of water, pour them all over the offering and the wood. And after they had done this, he said, do the same thing again. Let's make sure this is really wet. And then when they were finished, he said, now do it a third time. Let's just really make sure that everyone is aware this is totally saturated wood. So they did as he said. And the water ran around the altar, filling the trench. And at the usual time for offering the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet walked up to the altar and he prayed, O Lord, God of history, not a storm god, not a personification of nature, not an idol to throw myself before. O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who promises and the God who responds, the God of history, the God who acts. Prove today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant. Prove that I have done all that is in your word. Oh, Lord, answer me. Answer me so these people will know that you, oh, Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back to you again. Well, now immediately, the fire of the Lord flashed down from heaven, consuming the offering, the wood, the stones, the entire altar. It even licked up all the water in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell down on their face to the ground and cried out, the Lord, he is God. Yes, the Lord is God. So the God who speaks is also the God who acts. The God who promises is the God who delivers. Not because of a whole group of priests who've worked themselves up, shouting and moaning and groaning, cutting themselves with knives, demonstrating as much as they possibly can their great sincerity. It's not sincerity that moves God, it's the truth. And so in a real calm and deliberate way, Elijah is just calling to the Lord, manifest yourself. Show your people this day who you are. And God does. And the people then respond. And it concludes that Elijah commanded them to seize all the prophets of Baal. Don't let a single one escape. So the people seized them all, and Elijah took them down to the Kishon Valley and killed them there. Let's put an end to this injustice, put an end to this dehumanizing and debasing cult that is destroying the heart and soul of God's people. Well, that's the story that we want to talk about here tonight. Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And you say to yourself, as you sit here tonight, what possible implications could that have for me? We are, after all, not idol-worshiping polytheists, people who give personal names to forces of nature and bow down and worship them. No, we are sophisticated members of the 21st century, the age of science that explains how everything works. Well, yes and no. I would like to suggest to you here this evening that this passage absolutely relates to us, because in our hearts, all of us are idolaters. That the same problem that Israel was facing in the 9th century BC is not just their problem, it's a problem of humanity, and it is our problem as well. And so I want to walk through the narrative with this in view. Let's think about this from 3 perspectives. What is the foundation of idolatry? what sustains idolatry, and what is the end of idolatry. And my hope is that you will find yourself able to connect with this in much the same way I have as I've thought this through. Beginning first with the fact that worshiping idols is really something that emerges from the broken and twisted heart of humanity. There's something wrong with the heart of men from the very earliest moments. Paul says in Romans chapter 1, even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their speculations and their foolish hearts were darkened. Fascinating, isn't it? The origin of idolatry is an indictment against God. They did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. There is something in the fallen heart of humanity that resists God. There's something in the fallen heart of humanity that is suspicious of God. Is he really good? Is God really sufficient? And in that moment of suspicion that echoes through the heart of every human being emerges a substitute for God. And that is what an idol is. Paul goes on, he says, professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man, of birds, of four-legged animals, and crawling things. And this way, he's just describing the origin of the most primal and pervasive religious form in human history. It's animism. It's substituting the worship of the transcendent, one true God with aspects of his creation. This is a form of worship that is just as alive today as it has ever been. And you don't have to go more than to Africa, to Asia, to South America and Central America and parts of our own country to see that indeed exactly what he's describing there is how people engage with reality. Suppressing the inner knowledge that we all have, that there is a God in whose image we are made, a creator of all things and an owner in that sense also of all things, including ourselves. In our pride and in our rebellion against this God, we've chosen to go our own way and to justify our own pride and our own self-commitments to my thing, my way, life on my terms. We create a worldview that enables us to move to the top. And so for this reason, we create these substitute gods for the very deliberate purpose. How am I going to stay in control of my life? Let's think about this just a little bit more broadly as the Bible describes idolatry. In elevating man and nature to the ultimate reality, God is left as this sort of intangible, unapproachable, unknowable thing. So what is the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality, the thing around which everything revolves? It's around you and me. It's around forces of nature. As the Greeks put it, man is the measure of all things. Who says? I say. Okay? That's what that means. I'm citing the Greek sophist by the name of Protagoras. This is 5th century BC stuff. This is not postmodern America. This is the history of humanity. Look, we want to be at the center. We want to be in control. And how do we do that? We do that through the cultivating of affluence, dedicating our lives to the accumulation of things, which Paul says in Colossians 3, verse 5, he says, don't be greedy. He's not saying that there's something inherently wrong with wealth. Let's be clear on that point. But there is also this fallen desire for wealth and all that it comes to represent. Beware, he says. Don't be greedy, for greedy, a greedy person is an idolater, worshiping the things of the world. We are in danger in a culture that is as materialistic and affluent as ours, to subtly, and maybe not so subtly, see the accumulation of wealth as the center of a life well lived. That's what life is really all about. Security, elevating security to the final thing, the ultimate ambition, the ultimate goal of life, to which Isaiah says in Isaiah chapter 31, verse 1, he says, "Woe to you who turn to Egypt for help and rely on horses and trust in chariots because they are many and in horsemen because they are strong, but they do not look to the Holy One of Israel or seek the Lord." Trusting in strength, our army stronger than your army. Our army will keep us safe. And that elevation of power enables us then to convince ourselves that as long as that power remains and whatever we can do to sustain it, then things will go well for us. That's our ultimate. The intellect and accomplishment of the individual often are elevated to the status of an idol. In Genesis 11, verse 4, it says, "Come, let us build a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. Let us make a name for ourselves." Just that ability to assert your pride. What you're able to accomplish, what you're able to do, a real doer and a man of action is this person, a real thinker. You know, that's what it's really all about. And so our value system and everything about our lives revolves around the cultivating of this pride of intellect and accomplishment. And that's really at the heart of what we today call really classical humanism. It's the elevation of man and his potential above all things and making it the standard of all things. Stimulation. Probably none of us here have this issue in our idolatry bag. But Paul says of the Philippians, he says, their God is their appetite. They brag about shameful things. And they only think about life here on the earth. You know, with affluence comes the need to invest, right? Having a pile of money is not really very satisfying. You can't sleep on a bag of coins. Be very uncomfortable like this. You can't eat them. You can't do much with them. But you can buy a lot of stuff with them. And what you buy tells a lot about where is your heart and what we buy. We're a consumer culture and we are deeply, deeply invested in stimulation. Sexual stimulation. The distraction of living life with a thing in your hand that you're constantly touching and images are popping up. And we've become a bit of an ADD culture. Because of this addiction that we've cultivated to stimulation. Can't sit still. I was talking to a guy just 3 weeks ago, an educated man, a very talented individual. And he was talking about the fact that when he interacts with a group of Christians that he meets with regularly, he says, it has to be images moving pretty rapidly and content lasting not more than 12 minutes. I said, "How is that possible?" He said, "Well, because that's all the people can sit for. That's all the people will want to do." Are you here? We're now 20 minutes into this conversation tonight. How is that phone? Is it like, push the button. Is it hard? Are you resisting? Stimulation. an influence. The ultimate self-assertion, I will make myself like the Most High God. So this is what we are talking about when we talk about the heart of idolatry, is the elevation of things within human experience and human accomplishment that we essentially deify, that we bow down and serve with our lives. Things that really fit into three categories. First, that they are things that we rely on. And so the idol becomes that thing that we can't live without, that we must have. And in not having it, we live in fear. And so that is a big driver to idolatry. It's the fear and the anxiety in our hearts that this thing that my life depends upon really hangs in the balance. How's the stock market doing? Or whatever it is that controls your heart. There is the whole identity question. Who am I? And why do I matter? And what is my life all about anyway? We have to define that some way. I matter because is not a complete sentence. It's a setup. It's an opportunity for us to say, my life matters because what? And that what is the center of your life. That is the defining thing about you. Why do you matter? How do you answer that question, even here tonight? That will reveal everything that's in your heart. And then, of course, our idols are the things that are a standard for us to judge all things. If we have elevated stimulation to the point of a sort of divinity in our life as a thing that we bow down to, are sacrificing for, and just can't get enough of, then things that aren't stimulating are now uninteresting, unimportant, not worth my time. People who are not stimulating or stimulate me or I find interesting for whatever selfish reasons I have don't matter to me anymore. And all of the criteria that we bring to evaluate and judge ourselves and the world around us really has a foundation, and outside of a relationship with the one true God, it is an idol that we construct. All of us, in one way or another, struggle and bend under the voice of the idols that resonate through our culture. With that in view, I think it would be very helpful for all of us here tonight to be able to take that step back and say, I wonder what are those things that deeply compete for my heart? Those things that I put in the place of God. Is it that need that I have that people recognize me for my value, and therefore if I'm not getting the press that I so richly deserve that I become angry and resentful? Is it that people don't recognize my beauty or my whatever it is, the contribution I'm making that I must have, I must be reinforced in this way? Is it the thing that we're trying to control our economic life so that we never have to depend upon God or anyone else and to live that kind of American dream of total self direction? All of us are struggling in varying ways in this regard because we are a culture that is as polytheistic as any of the world's cultures has ever been. And those idols that we construct need to be sustained. And so they exact a certain cost. Our idols do, the demands of our heart. And those costs can be quite expensive, quite prohibitive. And when our idols are threatened, maybe we're not getting the kind of self-respect we feel that we deserve. Maybe we're not having the kind of accomplishment that we feel that we must have to justify our existence. When we are feeling that there are powers outside of ourselves that are controlling us in certain ways, then we become more agitated and the need to control, just as it was in the days of Baal, begin to emerge. Look what it says. they called on Baal from morning till noontime, shouting his name, answer us. They shouted louder. And following the normal custom, they cut themselves with knives and swords until the blood gushed out, and they raved all afternoon. Well, that just sounds like an awful lot of people I know, like myself, at various points in my life. That's right. When we find ourselves threatened, we have to ask ourselves, what is the power that I'm being threatened by? And here you see the real heart of idolatry. We ask ourselves this question. It sounds kind of fanatical, doesn't it? Yelling louder and louder, cutting themselves. We don't do that. No, actually, we do that. And young people today, an increasing number, are cutting themselves, even cutting themselves on the inside of the thighs so that no one sees that it's there, but they know that it's there. And these cuts are given to elicit some feeling, some sense, what? That I matter. Because why? Because I don't know why I matter. That's why. I just know that if I'm going to matter, I've got to be at the center of it. And so that whole sense of who am I is crippling to young people. And you know what? We don't get over it as adults, older adults either. It is so deeply the undercurrent behind what's going on in our lives, the sort of fights that we have with other people, the battles for control that we have in our marriage and our family, the resentments that they hold towards other people. This is fanaticism. What is fanaticism? Fanaticism is when we take a good thing and make it the main thing. Is it important to have a sense of who you are? Absolutely. Is that the question that must be answered? It is not. The question that must be answered is there a God in whose image I exist? I don't know that I can matter or that anything matters until I know that there is purpose in the universe as a whole. Fanaticism, idolatry occurs when we take something that is intrinsically good and make it the ultimate good. Or to put it in another way, fanaticism is being all in for something that's false or that isn't worth the cost. We can surely get alongside of people's deep devotion to the things that they're into and in many ways admire them for their efforts, because it's sometimes in applying ourselves intellectually or with sports or whatever that there is an ennobling effect to that. It does bring out the best of who we are in many respects. Not in all respects, but in some respects. But when that thing becomes the thing that drives us, now we've morphed into the realm of idolatry, and that's the controlling thing, which is false, and which is now exacting a cost that is beyond our ability to pay. And we pay deeply in our hearts when we are all in for something that's not worth our being all in for. And that brings us then to our final point, the failure of idolatry. The failure of idolatry, again, going back to this narrative where it just says there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. Nobody cared. There was no one to hear these pleas because what they were worshiping was not God. And there are times in our lives where God allows us a kind of a window of insight, an opportunity, a moment of clarity to really piece together, to kind of connect the dots in our lives about what we've been about. Because idols have the capacity and the effect of shaping our hearts. And this, my friends, is a very important point that I want us to think about here tonight. It is what we hold up as the ultimate and what we serve, and we are all servants of something, that determines our inner life that determines what kind of people we become. And when we are all in for something that's not worth it and that is not God and that is in that sense an idol, we pay the price inwardly. We ask ourselves, where does that anger come from? Okay, it can come from a variety of things. But one of the things that anger frequently comes from is that place where I've been frustrated in the actualization, the realization of something that is so important to me that I must have, that in not having it, I've responded in anger. What you want shapes your heart, and in not having it, anger is a response. It's not just that I want to have a good marriage. It's that I want to have a spouse who views me a certain way and treats me a certain way like I so richly deserve as the God to myself that I am. Right? Maybe some of us can relate a little bit to that. Some of us react in a sort of a depressive state. We just feel this lagging sense of not being fulfilled in life. And so you say, well, you know, I come by it honestly. I'm from a long line of depressed people or whatever. That's okay. But maybe one of the big contributing elements to your depression is that you have been all in for something that's not worth it. Maybe you're depressed because your ambitions have not provided for you the kind of results that you wanted, and in response to that, your anger has turned to this depressive place. And now that's just kind of where you are, in that constantly let down place. Why are you let down? It's because the thing that you've held forth as the ultimate has not come through for you. That's why. Let's think about that. Think about the fact that there is a spiritual and indeed even a moral component to things like anger and depression, and the answer to that can be found in the thing that we're all in for. We find ourselves withdrawing from people. Why is that? Well, because people are complicated, because people suck, you know, whatever it is. Or maybe we withdraw because we've concluded that we can't get from them what we need from them, which is our idol, which is our affirmation and our sense that we matter because so-and-so told me so. And that's why we're withdrawing. Or bitterness, the fact that the feeling that I should have been treated better than I was, and I deserve to be treated better than I am, which is usually not a good proposition. Never ask what you deserve, because it will not turn out well for you. But we live in bitterness. We just can't let it go. Because why? Because we just need that affirmation. Or anxiety, the fear that the things that I've put my hope and trust in aren't going to deliver for me. And we live in very anxious times in that regard. We are a neurotic culture to a very high degree. And part of it, my friends, a big part of it, maybe for most of us, the lion's share of this is that we are all in for something that can never satisfy. And in that sense, we're in the wrong. And we're paying in our bodies the due consequence of our error. Burnout. I'm just tired. Why? Because the thing that I've been pursuing that I thought would give meaning is just more elusive and more difficult than I could ever have thought. And so I just have become cynical within myself. Look, I think that that's a pretty good description of a lot of our culture right there, and it's probably a pretty good description of some of the inner life of most of us here tonight. And I want to ask you to connect the dots between how you're feeling on that right-hand column and how you've been all in for something that's not God and how you've allowed that to control your life. But let's end where the text takes us. which is that Elijah is putting this call out to people to return to the Lord. How much longer will you waver, hobbling between two opinions, he says. It's a binary choice. It's not a little of this and a little of that. It's either the Lord Yahweh is God or he's not. He's not kind of God or sometimes God or for some people God. If he is the creator and sovereign of the universe, then he is the only God and the only absolute. So if he is the Lord God, follow him. If he's not, if Baal's God, okay, follow him. But there's a moment of decision that God would have us come to, a moment where we are prepared to take a stand one way or the other on this very important topic of what is ultimately real. To come back to God as Israel did that day is to identify what are those idols that animate my heart and that are behind how I think, what I value, and what I do. What are those idols that compete for our affections that are not God? Are we able to offer a critique of those idols? To engage our mind to be able to say, that's not God, and here's why. I love what the proverb says. In Proverbs 21, verse 22, he says, the wise man scales the city of the mighty and brings down the stronghold in which they trust. And so this is a thing where God is calling on us as Christians to think biblically about the world around us and about our own, the things that cultivate our own inner lives. Values that we have never questioned before, but would shape us and mold us, and to be able to ask the question, is that really from God? Is that really true? Is that really the way things are? And just to be able to engage on that level and allow ourselves to be a social critic and a critic of our own inner life. Where do these values come from, and are they from God? And lastly, to then, having kind of walked through that, to identify, here are the things competing for my heart, and here's why they're not God. So now I ask, what is the thing that these idols have been constructed to do for me? Are they there to tell me why do I matter? Who I am? Am I relying on these things because I think that they're going to make me secure and comfortable in life? Those are the things that the Lord wants us to draw from him. And so what does it mean then to trust God in those very areas where we have erected idols in our lives to control our life? To be able to recognize an identity as a child of God, not because we're so smart or so clever or so accomplished, but just simply because we matter to God for no other reason, and that everyone else in his image does also. And to be able to then step aside from the pride that always surrounds the cultivation of our idols to a place of humility where we reach out to God and we say, thank you, Lord, that you do not treat me according to my merits, but you treat me according to your mercy. That's what this is really all about. The idolatry that we pursue is a barrier between ourselves and God. And that barrier has been broken down finally and uniquely in the person of Jesus Christ, who took upon himself on the cross the burden of our guilt. He died for all those altars that we have erected around our lives and have bowed down and worshiped, which are not God, which are God's substitutes. And he says, I'll pay the price for that. I'll be the sacrifice that provides atonement between a guilty humanity and a holy God. And in approaching the cross of Christ with humility to say, be merciful to me, an idolater. Forgive me. Allow me to be reconciled to you so that in being reconciled to you, I can have that rightful relationship of Heavenly Father to child, so that I can learn in a fresh and deep way, in an authentic way, what does it mean to really be the person that you've created for me to be, and to begin to live a life of real victory where those idols that have held us perhaps for decades as slaves, we find freedom from those things. And we find in Christ the sufficiency and the goodness that our broken hearts have long denied. So that is, I think, the heart of this pretty sweet narrative on the destruction of idolatry.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.